So do you want to be rich? What is the definition of rich anyway? We'll cover that question and many more during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Each week at this time, financial planner Kevin McKinley offers information and advice on your money. And in honor of the 4th of July holiday this week, we will also learn more about achieving financial independence. And you can help by sharing your personal finance question. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
And happy Independence Day week. So this study, tell us about this recent study that found that the definition of rich is difficult to quantify.
Yeah, Dan, it depends on who is responding to the question. If it's an article in the New York Times regarding income and based on a survey from the organization YouGov, and they asked different people of different incomes and said, what income would you define as being rich? And in the bottom quartile, people who made less than $30,000 a year, it was $293,000. People who make $30,000 to $60,000 a year said it was close to $400,000. People who make $60,000 to $120,000 a year, it was about $425,000 a year, they thought was the income you needed to be defined as being rich. And people who made over $120,000 a year said you needed a nice even $500,000 of earnings per year to be considered rich.
Funny. So we the more money we make, the more money we think we need to be rich.
This is correct.
Yes. So how many people in America actually earn those types of incomes?
Well, when they take these numbers, there are a lot of variables involved. The location in which people live and work has something to do with it, whether it's a family versus single, or you have two income earners or one, or if it's one-time income or ongoing. A lot of people have bonuses or some kind of sale that of property that gets into their income that can skew it for a year. And then finally, gross income versus adjusted gross income. But usually the figures play out pretty close to this. If you are making $51,000 per year, you are in the top half of income for America. To get into the top quarter of earners, you need to make $67,000 per year. To get in the top 10%, you need about $113,000 per year. And to get in the top 1%, it's about $380,000 per year. So since those responses to the survey were all around $300,000 to $500,000 a year, they were actually pretty close to the truth, because I would say being in the top 1% or 2% of income is probably a decent definition of being rich, at least according to income.
Yeah. So why do you think it is that the definition of rich rises with our income?
Well, income generally does not go as far as one might think when it's out in the ether, meaning that you remember when you were a kid or a teenager and you were thinking about your first paycheck, or you were finding out what grown-ups actually made, and you thought, oh my gosh, if I ever make $20,000 a year, I will have so much money. Yeah. I won't even know what to do with it. The more income you make, generally taxes take up a greater percentage of your income. And then, as we alluded to, the income and cost of living disparity, $50,000 of earnings in Wisconsin is the equivalent to $120,000 in Manhattan. So that income disparity means that someone who lives in Manhattan may not feel rich, even though they're making $120,000 a year and would be in the top 10% of earners. There's another location study, too, that that's a little bit more fuzzy, but it said that neighbor's income is that your neighbor's income goes up, your happiness actually goes down, and the wealthier people you live by, the more likely you are to spend frivolously on things you regret and less likely to save money. So as you mentioned, it's all relative. And I mentioned this a few years ago, but a while back, I'd been talking with two separate people in my grown-up job, and one of the people told me, he said, well, I don't have a whole lot of money. He said, I think my net worth last year was probably $250 million. And then I also had A gentleman.
Only,
who,
yeah.
Only, right. A gentleman who contacted me and was very cagey and understandably reserved about his situation, but we talked a couple times. And he said, well, I after interviewing you and several other advisors, I think I'm ready to invest. And the whole time he had told me he had a significant amount of money to invest. And I was very curious about it because I didn't press him on it. But once he finally told me, he said, I'm ready to talk with you. And I said, okay, what were you thinking about doing? He said, well, as I mentioned, I have a significant amount of money to invest. It's close to $10,000. And to him, that was a significant amount of money. So as you mentioned, it's all relative.
Yeah. Sounds like there's a little keeping up with the Joneses going on here, too.
Yeah, that's right. And that's within a mile or so. That's what tends to of your own home. That's what tends to dictate how you feel, whether you feel wealthy or you feel poor.
Yeah. I have a dear friend with the last name of Jones, too. So how do you, Kevin, define rich?
I define it as being financially independent, and as both of the regular listeners to this show know, I base that on what you actually spend, not what you earn, what you have, how it's invested. I base it on what you spent. And in honor of this week's celebration of our nation's independence, later on we're going to go over what you need to be financially independent and how to check your progress towards getting that goal and how to know in retirement how much you can spend at a given age so that you can remain financially independent.
Sounds good. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a question for Kevin, he has an answer. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it is time now for the On Your Money email bag, and a listener named Sandy asks, I'm wondering where I can get information on when to take Social Security benefits. So, Kevin, what advice do you have for Sandy?
Where is the rest of the false price?
There is none. What's wrong, Sandy?
And we're still taking this question. Standards are slipping. Sandy, you can start at the Social Security Administration because they will be able to tell you your own situation and your own numbers and the different amounts that you can take at various A's, which is the most important factor in determining when to take it. Go to ssa.gov, ssa.gov, and you can either check online or you can call them or you can make an office visit. However, you might want to schedule that office visit well in advance because there is talk of closing several of the SSA offices around the country, so you may have to drive a little further than what you were planning.
Really? Okay. Well, so what do you do then?
It's time to start fiddling with the figures. Many people do have special situations where they might have been married and divorced, and maybe they can claim on their ex-spouse's earnings that's a higher earning than their own or the current one. There is a file and suspend strategy where a higher earner in a couple actually files for Social Security and suspends it so that his or her spouse may then receive the spousal benefits. In the meantime, his actual benefit keeps climbing. And the reason people do that is so that they can, of course, get more money later on, the longer they live, but also when one member of a married couple passes away, the smaller Social Security check goes away as well. So if there is a higher check on which to base that, the surviving member will get that higher check. There are a couple online services that you can use too. These are paid services. SSIncomePlanner.com is about $10. And then Social Security Solutions has partnered with Kiplinger Magazine, and they have an online solution that's about $50, or you can speak with a representative for about $125 or so. SSIncomePlanner.com, SocialSecuritySolutions.com, and we'll put links up to that website at OnYourMoney.com later on today.
And I know, Kevin, we have discussed this before, but what are some of the general rules of thumb that would-be Social Security recipients should follow?
You know what? We have discussed this before. One thing I found, Joy, after doing roughly 400 of these shows, not everyone listens to every single show.
I don't understand that. You know what? I'm going to make a confession, Kevin. I was going to say that now that my husband's retired, now I'm really paying
You're
attention
paying
to
attention,
this.
Attention, finally.
Yes. So now I'm going to take notes. All right. So please tell me.
Okay. Well, the most popular age to take Social Security right now is as soon as you can get it. It's age 62. And you can wait until 70 if you want. And usually the checks do keep marching up for every single year that you do wait. But regardless, when you take it, you usually have to live until 80 to make waiting work, because a lot of bright people come to me and say, well, I want to wait because I know my check rises by 7 or 8% a year for every year that I wait. Well, for every year that you wait, though, you're missing out on a year's worth of those slightly smaller checks, and it takes a long time for a slightly larger check to offset that year's worth of slightly smaller checks. So if you don't need the money, usually it's best to wait. But do not spend down your assets while you're waiting. I hate to see people say, well, I have, several $100,000 I'm going to live off of until 70, and then that money will be gone, but at 70, I'll turn on the faucet for my Social Security. And that can be dangerous because you could need that money for an emergency. You could, at some point in the future, be able to maybe invest it at a higher interest rate and still keep it safe, but only delay it if you're already financially independent. And we're going to talk about those numbers later on in today's show.
We will in our Smart Assets segment. Maria in Green Bay emails, it has been my experience that that most people define being wealthy as having roughly twice the wealth that they currently have.
That's a very good definition. I have very few people who do describe themselves as rich. Other people might describe them as rich, but those people do not describe themselves as being rich.
This is a financial independence edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin will answer your personal finance question, if you have one, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. One open line for you. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
If I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
well, I'd buy you a house.
I would buy you a house.
And if I This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, Kevin McKinley. Looking for your questions about obtaining financial independence, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Ted in Madison is with us. Hello, Ted.
Hello, Joy. I had a, and Kevin, thank you for taking my call. I've been a long-time listener. First time with a question, and it goes along with the theme of the financial independence.
Great.
So we my wife and I own our home, outright own it. That was a goal of ours. Did that Dave Ramsey's Total Money Makeover, started it years ago. So we're free and clear from our house, but we have three kids and want an extra bedroom. So we're thinking of moving in the neighborhood up to a bigger house. But we were looking, and the question I have is, since we own this house, should we sell it or rent it? We're going to have a bigger house. It's going to be a bigger mortgage than we were used to and just paying a mortgage. But do we take all the equity from this house, 100% of it, and put it into the new house, and then closer to being free and clear financially independent? Or do we say this is an investment opportunity for trying to play the long game here and say, here's a way we can make clear, $1,000, $1,200 a month, from here on out? Yeah. But we're going to have this larger mortgage, with this bigger one. What do we do here? I guess we're kind of torn. It's a good problem, I guess.
Sure.
We're in a good situation either way, but we just don't want to be foolhardy and just sell the house, take all the money, and say, look back and say that could have been a good income property. What do you think?
Ted, have you ever owned rental property before?
I personally haven't, but my dad, my family has owned rental properties my entire life, and I've worked at it with my dad. He's still a landlord, so he's got a lot of opinions.
Okay. Fathers usually have a lot of opinions. In my case, you can ask my kids. My opinions are just the truth. That's all they are. So you have some experience in knowing what it's like to be a landlord, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And one of the things that your dad will probably tell you is that being a landlord, especially of residential real estate, is a great way to get rich really, really, really slowly. And part of the reason is because, yeah, you clear $1,000 to $1,200 or so, but you don't have control over all the different expenditures that and the furnace, the roof, the toilet, the sink, the air conditioning, all this other stuff that you have to pay for right away as soon as possible to be a good landlord. And you have now have two houses you have to deal with. So what happens is you generally end up, the extra cash should probably go into a checking account that you're getting in rent, and then you'll find yourself using a lot of that cash to keep the house up, that we all do when we own homes, but that's where it goes. So I'm okay with that idea. Do you have a lot of other cash or liquid savings set aside besides the paid up value in your house?
Yes, we do. We have, a pretty large emergency fund, and I would say so. We do have liquid assets.
Okay, and are both you and your wife working outside the home?
Yes.
Okay, are you maxing out your at-work retirement plan savings?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, good for you. Yeah, I'm okay with this. As long as you have enough liquid cash where you've got about a year's worth of expenses, not just for your own personal expenses, but also for the home. And the fact that you do have some experience in getting down and dirty with residential real estate and renting it out. One of the problems I have with this, when people say, gosh, it seems, my brother-in-law owns 50 properties. All he does is collect checks every month. Somebody else takes care of it. Usually when people say that, they don't realize how much work the brother-in-law had to do over 10 or 20 years to get to that point. How many doors he had to unlock at 3 o'clock in the morning, or toilets he had to unclog at 3 o'clock in the morning, to get to that point where he built up all these properties, and quite frankly, all the risk he had to take, where most people borrow money to purchase these properties and they're on the hook to the bank with it, and the bank wants to be paid whether or not the property is rented or not. So yes, I would say this is a decent idea. I would still actually prefer that you keep the cash set aside from the second home, but I would have you get mortgages on both of your properties, and then have the nest egg there to keep you safe. But if you said no, we just want to roll this over, get a mortgage on the new place, and then collect the rent from the old place, that's okay too.
That's okay, because my wife's she doesn't care what I think. She cares what you think.
That's right.
I'm going to tell her that. I'm going to tell her you said that, though.
That's it.
We should swap wives, because my wife doesn't care what I have to say about it.
Hey, Ted, I'm curious, what are your dad's opinions on this?
Oh, he said, his big thing was just don't over-leverage ourselves. He says it's one thing to get a mortgage to pay for a rental property, and then, have a mortgage on that rental property. He says we're in a good position to do it, but he kind of, like Kevin said, he says, you realize it's a job. It's not just checks and mail. And, part of our thing was we just replaced the roof, the furnace, the air conditioner, the water. We had just done all these improvements, and now we're thinking of leaving. So it's kind of a way to, we plunged all this money into the house. Might want to enjoy it, because we don't anticipate any of those big expenses, at least in the short term. So
great.
Those were kind of his, like Kevin said, he had the same concerns as Kevin. So I think we're going to try to do it. Why not? Give it a shot.
Well, good luck. And wonderful, Ted. Thanks very much for the call. So if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money, and Chuck in Minocqua is with us now. Hello, Chuck.
Hi. I'd like to say that I've listened to Kevin for years and years, and I think the program is just terrific. So
very good, Chuck.
You sound like you meant that. That was very convincing, Chuck. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My question is that I'm 64 years old, and I've listened to you for years, and I took all your advice. I took out a mortgage on my house, and I got a home equity line of credit while I was still working. And I had to take the mortgage out because my wife divorced me after many, many years of marriage, but to keep my place here in Minocqua. But now I guess I'm in a position where I could pay the mortgage off, and I know that's against everything you've always said, but I pay $658 a month in interest, and the mortgage is at 4.5%. And of course, because I'm not working anymore, the banks won't refinance my mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
So my logic is that $658 a month is a lot, and since I don't have any income, I don't really pay any taxes anymore. So I'm wondering if I should just go ahead and pay my mortgage off and then end up into plus category again where I'm saving money versus living off of part of my savings to make my monthly payments.
Correct. And I'm with you on this. Do you have enough savings where even if you do pay the mortgage off, Chuck, you still have plenty of money on which to live, or would this kind of bring you down close to zero?
Oh, what's plenty of money?
12 months worth of living expenses.
Oh, well, theoretically, if I paid my mortgage off, I would be in a plus on my Social Security. In other words, I'd be taking in more money than I would spend a year.
Okay.
Plus, I'd still have 20 or 30 thousand bucks in the bank. So I don't know if that's good or not. And I still have my home equity line of credit, too.
Okay. The home equity line of credit is nice, and I would definitely recommend that you keep that regardless of what you decide to do. But it's very difficult in your situation, to once you do pay the mortgage off, to get the money back. There is no safe place you can go right now to earn that 4.5% interest back that you're paying on the mortgage. It's a very competitive rate, especially historically, but it's still, there's no places you can get a CD for 30 years that pays 4.5%. And so I'm going to lean towards telling you it's okay to pay the mortgage off, but would you have to take the money from savings or would you take it from a retirement account?
Savings. I don't have any retirement accounts. I never did that. I just saved money, so I've paid all the taxes and everything on it. And
okay.
My intent when I retired was to live off Social Security plus a little bit of my savings, and of course it would take me out a whole bunch of years. The mortgage was a 30-year mortgage, too,
mm-hmm.
by the way.
The only concern I have, and I'm okay with you paying this off, Chuck, the only concern I have is that you are going to end up house rich and cash poor. And that's okay as long as nothing bad happens that you would need that cash. The problem, of course, comes when you need the cash. Now, you mentioned having the home equity line of credit, and again, I would want you to not only keep that in place, pay any fees the lender charges you to keep it open, but also keep it open for as much as they'll allow, meaning don't just leave it at $15,000 or $20,000. Have it opened up for as much as the lender will allow you to have. But again, you run into a problem where you have this big expense, but you also have an interest, but then that's your liquidity as well as your house. So I'm okay with it. I like it for the time being for it too, but keep the home equity line of credit open just in case. And know too that several lenders, BMO Harris sent notices out to several people who had home equity lines of credit and said, hey, no offense, due to the economic conditions, we're going to have to either refinance this into a fixed rate home equity loan or just close it out and have you pay it off completely. And they tried to work with people to try to just not slam the door on them. But lenders, all lenders can do that, and many will in the future. And so the home equity line of credit is not quite as a permanent solution as a mortgage is. But then again, it's also not the great cost to which you alluded.
Thanks very much, Chuck, for the call, and good luck to you. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Kevin is with us just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. We have an open line for you if you have a personal finance question for Kevin at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time now for Smart Assets, and in honor of our nation's Independence Day celebration, we're going to talk about achieving financial independence. And Kevin, how do we do that?
It's the most frequently asked question we get, other than when does this show end?
Right.
We don't base it on income or assets or investments. I've dealt with probably thousands of different families in all different kinds of situations, and I've started to, after 26 years of working as a financial planner, I'm starting to get the hang of it, first of all. Yep. And second of all, I've developed some some thoughts on what makes people rich and financially independent. And so we base the formula on what you spend every single month.
And what is the formula?
Okay. Well, if you're going to start for those who are nearing retirement and saying, can we retire? First of all, add up your typical monthly expenses. And by the way, someone just gave me a great idea for this. When I said, well, what are your monthly expenses? She said, I had a hard time figuring this out. And a lot of people do actually struggle with it because there are fixed expenses and then there are variable expenses. And she said, I put two debit cards or two credit cards in my wallet. And for ones that were just the basic everyday expenses, like groceries, et cetera, I put those on one card. And then I put what I consider the variable expenses, the one-time or the non-recurring expenses on the other one. And then after a few months of doing that, I could track them from the two different accounts. But once you add up your typical monthly expenses, then subtract your Social Security checks that you expect in retirement or pension checks as well, and then multiply the net amount, the amount left over, by 200. And that's about how much you need to say, yes, we can retire comfortably. So if you are spending, say, $5,000 in a typical month and you're expecting $2,000 in Social Security checks in retirement, that leaves $3,000 left over that you have to cover. If you multiply the $3,000 times 200, that means a person in that situation should have about $600,000 in liquid assets before he or she could say, yes, we can retire comfortably.
I like that formula, and I like that two credit card idea. What about those who aren't quite old enough to retire?
Yeah, if you're still looking at, say, how are we doing now, it's still a great idea to add up those expenses. And if you're in your 20s, you should have about 10 times that amount saved up. So if you're spending $4,000 a month, it'd be nice if you had about $40,000. In your 30s, you should have 25 times your spending. In your 40s, you should have 50 times your monthly spending. And by the time you reach your 50s, you hopefully would have 100 times your typical monthly expenditures.
And how about retirees? How much can they spend per month?
Well, it depends on age and life expectancy. People in their 60s can divide their savings by 200, and that's how much they can spend every single month. In the 70s, they can divide their savings and investments by 100, and in their 80s, they can divide it by 50, and that's how much they can spend every single month. But I will say this. A lot of the people with whom I work are kind of transitioning from retiring and earning to, or from working and earning to retiring and spending. And when it comes to a big goal of retirees and who are early retirees, who are retiring, let's say, in the late 50s, early 60s, one of the things many of them want to do, understandably, is travel. And I recommend most people who have reached financial independence should spend that money traveling, in part because that typically gives people the most satisfaction for their expenditure, but also because we typically have a very narrow window in retirement when we can we have the time and the freedom to go wherever we want, but our physical ability is only going to last so long, and money typically does not run out before people's ability to enjoy it does, especially in terms of travel, when you need your knees and your eyes and your brain and your ears to get the most out of the experience. So if you are going to spend a little bit more than some of these figures that I've suggested on travel, I'm okay with that.
Good. I love to travel. Good advice. Back to the phones. Jackie in Eau Claire. Hi, Jackie.
Hi.
Yes, what's your question?
Good to talk to both of you. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not so much a question as an idea that I've used for several years in paying off debt. And when you have an amount due on a credit card that says, okay, your minimum payment this month is $20. Well, I always want to pay more because I want to get it paid off sooner. So I try to incorporate the date into the end of the payment, which is fine when it's in January because you're only going to have a one and then whatever changes, you know, for the date. But if it gets later in the year, all of a sudden, instead of doing a $20 payment, you're doing a $112 payment, you know? So, and as you do this, you get to where you want to pay more because you have to get that date incorporated in the end of the thing. The other thing about that is, and if you sit down and figure it out on paper, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, when you call to find out, you know, something about your account, whatever, and you say, well, okay, I've paid this, and if all of a sudden you're missing a month, you're missing a date, you know, you can tell yourself. You can follow the amount of money that you paid, and you already know the date you paid it on.
I'm sorry, Jackie, I'm a little bit slow. So January 5th, how do you incorporate that into your payment? I don't understand.
Okay, if your payment is $20 and it's January 5th, you would pay $21.05.
Gotcha.
The date. See the date? But it, and when it's the beginning of the year, it's real easy to do that. But when you get later in the year, it gets a little bit more difficult. The thing is, you're always paying more. You're always, no matter even if it's a dollar or two more.
And why do you do it this way, Jackie?
Because it gets to be more of a game and less about the money.
Oh.
It gets to be, okay, instead of paying $21 this month, I bet I can pay $31 this month or $41.05 this month or whatever. But incorporating the date takes the mentality away from being about, oh, my God, I owe this bill, and into more of a game.
All right. So no, what do you think?
I think it's a great idea. And knowing a lot of people's different finances, I'm not surprised. Many people do make little games out of this, and I like it for two reasons, one of which is it does take the emotions out of it, and it accelerates the payments. Every time Jackie tacks on a little bit of extra of that payment as the year goes by, that's money that is going to pay off debt and reduce interest and not going to be spent somewhere else, and then to start it all over again. And it, more importantly, she's paying attention to it. She has a system. A lot of times people have different systems for investing or saving or for paying bills, and just about any system is better than no system at all, and this fits in that category.
I know I would lose that game, though, because I don't understand the rules. But we'll thank you, Jackie, very much for sharing that. If you have a money game you'd like to share or a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
My mama told me, better shop around. Oh, yeah, you better shop around.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, and this is our Shop Around segment. The next time that you're at the cash register and the clerk asks you if you want your receipt, you may want to say no thank you. And why would we want to say no thank you, Kevin?
Well, because it's the polite way to say no, Joy. I don't know if your mother taught you that or not, but no. Well, you say no thank you because according to an article in Consumer Reports, they detailed a recent study from the Journal of American Medical Association that said that many receipts contain a high level of BPA. That's bisphenol A. There's thermal printed receipts, and that's a... endocrine adjusting chemical that has a lot of questionable drawbacks, and it's in a lot of the products we use. One study said that over 90% of us have some of this chemical in us. A lot of times it's in the coating used in cans or plastic bottles, etc. But it's worse when it's in those receipts because it's actually kind of a loose powder, and unlike the when the chemical is found in these different cans and bottles, the loose powder is easier to get on a person's skin. And some of the companies that print out their receipts say, no, we don't use our receipts are BPA free, but they do have BPS, which they contend is less dangerous, but the EPA says that the side effects and dangers of BPS is similar to BPA.
Oh my gosh, yikes. I always learn something from you, Kevin, but this is a new one. But what don't I need that receipt to return, you know, the thing I don't like anymore?
Yeah, now people are all thinking of how many times they put that receipt not only in their hand but in their mouth as they've tried to juggle their wallet and car keys, etc. You might need the receipt. You can use a lot of other alternatives to verify the purchase. Check with the store and say, you know, if you're buying a bottle of water, you do not need the receipt for that. So you can say, no, I don't need the receipt, or you can put it in the bag. Check with the store, though, to see if you're going to need it to return a particular item for it. If you do need to keep, have them put it some kind of a, you know, your plastic. If you put it on a debit card or a credit card, obviously that could serve as a verification of the purchase for it. Or what some people do is they place the, have the clerk put the receipt down on the counter and then take a quick picture of it with the smartphone, and then they save the document for it. And again, as long as the store is okay using that as a verification of the purchase, if you do need to return it, that's okay as well.
You know, and it's interesting. Only one or two stores that I've frequented actually give you the option of emailing you the receipt.
This is going to become more common, thanks to today's show, actually.
Yeah, there we go. So what if we still want to keep the receipt?
You may want to treat it as a hazardous material. Have them put it in the bag, and definitely not touching food like apples that you might be consuming, especially if you forget to wash it. Or you might want to keep a Ziploc plastic bag in your purse or your pocket and have the clerk drop it in the bag and save it for later. And then finally, if you do have to touch the receipt or whatever, make sure you wash your hands as quickly as possible and any other body part that the receipt comes in contact to.
I am kind of nervous about this now. This must be alarming to those who have to handle the receipts, like the cashier, right?
Right, and that's something that the employer should discuss with the employees, or the employee can ask and say, hey, no offense, I touch 1 million of these things every single week. Is there some way that that we could be sure that the receipts that we're handling don't have these chemicals in it, or is there a way that we could avoid handling it? There are special gloves you can use, those nitrile gloves, which I think are about, you know, 5 or 10 cents a pair. You can buy them by the box of 1,000 or whatever. Those should protect your hands. And if you need to count cash out, one of those little little rubber fingertip things that are kind of studded on it, that put one of those on top of the glove as well, so that you can still handle it. And who knows, wearing the gloves might actually protect cashiers and the customers from lots of germs that are floating around in those situations as well.
Yeah, so an emailed receipt might become more common in the future because of this. But gosh, I know, Kevin, you're not the scientist here, but I mean, gosh, can't they find some other way to? This is just the ink on the receipts that
is. Yeah, it's not the ink; it's a coating that's within it. It helps the color of the ink. And actually, one of the largest printers in the country of these is the old Appleton paper, which I think is called Appian right now. They stopped using BPA in 2006, but I believe they use a BPS alternative.
All right. Well, very interesting. Time now for more of your questions for Kevin at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Bruce in Toma. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning. Long time On Your Money awestruck listener.
There we go. Very good.
I listen to a lot of library learning series, and the last one I listened to was touting ETF, exchange-traded funds. They recommended that you use index-invested ETFs, and they were saying that they were better than mutual funds because the ETFs had lower costs. But I didn't understand why they had lower costs, and I was wondering what your thoughts were, Kevin.
Oh, well, you called the right place at the right time. Thank you for your kind words. I'm still waiting to get that long-time caller, first-time listener,
yes.
But I will gladly take a call from a long-time listener, first-time caller. The exchange-traded funds trade like stocks, meaning you can buy them and sell them all day, whereas these most mutual funds, the construct is the same, except with the mutual fund, you can only buy it or sell it at the end of the day's closing price. And that, otherwise, they're very similar. They're baskets of stocks according to a certain index or a certain theme or strategy or whatever that the ETF or mutual fund sponsor lays out when they say, we're going to buy these particular kinds of companies, stocks, bonds, whatever. And there's trillions of dollars in these ETFs. The advantage is, of course, is that you can buy and sell them. Expenses really aren't the big advantage. The advantage is that you can buy and sell them during the day. So if you say, hey, I want to get out of this right now, I'm going to sell it. And you can sell it at that particular time for the market price. That's also a disadvantage, though, because it means that the price is, first of all, much more volatile. It can swing around a lot during the day. The second thing is that many program trades, these computerized trading systems that use algorithms to trade securities by the millisecond, some of them use ETFs to trade, and that can make them even more volatile if a bunch of the computers all decide at one moment to buy or sell it. And the final thing is when you use a traditional open-end mutual fund, The purchase that you pay or sell it at the end of the day is the net asset value. That's actually what the shares are considered to be worth, the underlying securities within the fund. When you buy or sell an ETF, you sometimes can buy it at a discount to what the shares underneath are worth, or you can buy it at a premium to it and pay more for it. So if you're interested in liquidity and getting in and out of something quickly, ETFs are the way to go. If you want to make sure you're only buying it at the net asset value, then an open-end mutual fund that you can purchase at the close is probably preferable.
Thank you for that awesome call, Bruce. Margaret in Eau Claire is with us now. Hi, Margaret.
Good morning.
Morning.
We are looking at building an outbuilding for about $45,000, and we have a mortgage that that's down to about 20 years, and we're wondering if we should refinance our house and put it with our house, or if we should do an equity line of credit.
Okay. By building an outbuilding, you don't mean an outhouse, correct, Margaret?
No.
Okay, good. I just wanted to make sure. I would want to actually stop by and tour the $45,000 outhouse and actually use it, quite frankly.
That sounds wonderful, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Have you talked to the lender yet as to how you might tie this financing into your situation?
Yeah, and those are the two options they gave us.
Okay. And do you have sufficient liquid assets where you could write a check for this expenditure without causing undue harm to your situation?
No.
Okay. Then what
I have a Roth, but I don't want to take that out.
No, you don't want to take that out unless you have
no,
to.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
What I would do, and the lender has approved you either way, or they've just said these are your two options?
These are my two options.
Okay. I would want to make sure that the lender approved you one way or the other. Do you know what the interest rate is on your current mortgage, Margaret?
Yeah, it's 4.56.
Okay. And did the lender probably quote you a similar rate if you were to refinance your current mortgage?
Yep, it'd be 4.2, I believe.
Oh, great. Well, that's one reason to use the mortgage. As long as there's no payment penalty on it, you get the certainty of payments. You can extend it out further over 30 years. And yes, you're kicking the can down the road. But if you use the home equity line of credit, the good news is you may get an even lower interest rate to start, but that interest rate can go up. And the home equity line of credit can be closed on you technically at any time. Whereas the mortgage, you get a lot more certainty that they're not going to close it on you as long as you keep making that minimum payment. So I would definitely have you go with refinancing the mortgages for as much as the lender will allow, which is usually 80% of the loan to value, and do it for 30 years, not for the 15 or whatever, because typically in most situations, if you take out a 30-year mortgage and then make the payment that the 15-year would have required, you'll still pay the mortgage off in about 15 and a half to 16 years. But in the meantime, you get the flexibility that anytime you want, you can drop down to the lower payment required by the actual 30-year mortgage.
Okay, sounds good.
Thanks very much, Margaret, for the call. Paul in Madison is with us now. Hello, Paul. What's your question?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So the gist of it is I'm trying to get some information about starting a small business with very limited resources. So I'm in a situation where I have an architecture degree, but I'm not licensed yet, but I could still start a small business and do small-scale stuff on my own. I've been unemployed since the end of January. My wife is due in September, so I'm kind of in crisis mode right here, mm-hmm. trying to figure out how to bring in some income. But I can't. I've had people say you should go out on your own, but I just can't think of how that would work at this point in time. So I'm wondering if you have any advice.
Sure. When you say your wife is due, did you order her from another country and she's coming in? I don't understand.
Well, in that case, I could probably cancel the order.
But yeah, if you paid for it with a credit card. So you're going to have this baby in the fall. You're wondering about should you go out and start up on your own?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, if you can find someone who is willing to pay you, and like you said, it's something you can do that's still legal for it, absolutely. And you can do that by, you know, if I said to you, hey, today, Paul, you have to start this up, what would your first step be to getting this going?
My first step is trying to talk to my mentor who started his business, but he's got 30 years on me. So that's what I'm trying to do is get some more information from someone who's already been there. But then probably working on a website and stuff like that to start doing some promoting.
That's a very good idea. And keep in mind, you can begrudge him his 30 years of experience. He's also 30 years closer to death than you are, too. So he probably wishes he could trade places with you, actually. Yeah, I think that's exactly what you should do, and I think you should start doing it. And just understand, especially in a professional services business, it's really tough. The good news is you get to be your own boss. The bad news is you're responsible for everything. But if there are no other suitable employment opportunities out there, you might as well start your own gig. And I will tell you this, Paul, people a lot dumber and a lot less resourceful than you have gotten through this situation that you and your wife and soon-to-be child are going to be in. And so it's going to feel like the end of the world several times over again, but have confidence that you will be able to get through it.
All right.
All right. Good luck, Paul. Gosh, lots of excitement in the near future for you. Let's go next to Christine in New Glarus. Hi, Christine.
Hi. I'm returning to school, grad school, and I'm in my late 40s, and I'm wondering, is it always better to utilize any student loans, federal loans, whatever, federal loans, any student loans versus tapping into the equity in my home to pay for college?
Absolutely. I would much rather have you tap student loans, especially. Have you applied for financial aid yet through the school, Christine?
Yes. Yeah, okay. And I received the maximum $20,500 for 1 year of grad school through
okay.
the Stafford program.
You've already received that money?
Well, yes, it's in the. I haven't. It was approved, and it's going to be. So I just need to start school, and then the future.
Okay. Will that be enough, or you need more?
I'm going to need. The following year, I'll need another 20, and then I'll need another 10 for a summer program. So the 10, I will have to either come up with cash or apply for even more.
Okay. My preference is that you go the student loan route first, knowing that if you keep your home and do you have a home equity line of credit established already?
Well, I own my home completely, so I have a substantial amount of equity.
Okay, but you don't have any income right now?
Yes, I do have income.
You do have income. Okay, I would go back to the bank and for sure get the home equity line of credit established. And even, and this sounds crazy to some people, if you can get a 30-year mortgage, I would establish that as well and put those assets just in the bank, just leave them there, and so that the money will be there if you need it to pay off the extra expenses in the coming years. But if there's some situation where you can get a more favorable loan terms, you can use those. But I would definitely have you do that right away and at least get a home equity line of credit, and I'd actually rather have you probably tap that home equity line of credit for the subsequent year's costs.
All right, Christine, thanks very much for your call. Good luck to you. Let me just share a Peter in La Crosse emails. I love the show. I often listen 3 times a week. You make a great team. When my middle daughter was about 14, she asked, "Daddy, are we rich?" We were struggling to meet every bill, and every penny was going to raising our kids. I told her we weren't rich, but we had enough to get by, which made us feel rich. Our kids didn't get everything they wanted, but they got everything they needed. Being rich, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder. So,
that's an excellent response, and that those lyrics could actually be a song right there. My kids have asked me the same question, are we rich? And I've said, well, I am. You're not, but I am. So get to work.
Well, Peter, we are rich for having wonderful listeners like you. How's that? We have time for the website of the week.
Shoeboxed.com. Shoeboxed.com allows you to scan your receipts with a smartphone and the camera, organize them, keep them safe, especially for tracking expenses, whether it's you want to know where the money's going or you need it for tax or business purposes. Shoeboxed.com, and we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Excellent. And 4 more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He is with us just about every week at this time for information and advice on your money. We are live Tuesday mornings, repeated, rebroadcast Tuesday evenings and Sunday mornings. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.